essentially what bias is that we're skewing the setup of the argument in a way that's going to cloud the way we interpret the results. So if we only grab people from, you know, a wealthy tennis club to study, that's maybe not going to be generalizable to the rest of the population. If we only study men, which is often what we see in research, that information is maybe not going to be generalizable. And so those kinds of biases, I think it's easy for us to see. Oh, a drug company funded that study. That's biased. But what we don't realize is that as an individual and as a consumer, we also are at risk of having our own personal bias cloud or maybe rose color the lens through which we're seeing information. And I would think the one that is the most prominent for a consumer is something we call confirmation bias, which is that we have a set of beliefs and we are way more likely to align ourselves with people, with media, with pictures, with information that confirms the thing that we already think.
Welcome to the Anthropology Podcast. I'm your host, Megan Walker. As a former naturopathic doctor and anthropologist, I align the intersection of personal performance, purpose, and innovative thinking in badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. Anthropology is the study and science of what makes an entrepreneur think, feel, and perform in a path compelled by a vision for helping others, solving problems, while building a life on your own terms. Together, we are exploring the health, mindset, and strategies that distinguish the world's best entrepreneurs. This is the Anthropology Podcast. Welcome to episode 224 of the Anthropology Podcast. I am really looking forward to the conversation we are about to have. I am joined today by my friend, Dr. Jordan Robertson. She is the founder of Clarity Health, the host of the Women's Health Unplugged podcast. She is the curator of, I think, the funniest memes on the internet on her Instagram profile. And more than anything, Jordan is a critical thinker. She has a capacity to look at complex scientific issues and quickly pull out and discern what is relevant, what is evidence-based, and frankly, what do we need to know? We had a conversation today because we wanted to take the elusive let's follow science and apply it to our everyday lives, whether it's conversations related to the pandemic, everyday headlines, or your particular health concerns. We go through and Jordan provides a framework for you to be able to think critically yourself about the information about health that is relevant to you and what you can leave by the wayside. It is my pleasure to introduce you to my friend, Dr. Jordan Robertson. Dr. Jordan Robertson, welcome to the Anthropology Podcast.
Thanks so much, Megan. I'm excited to be here.
Well, we have a big agenda for today. We were chatting it out before we got on to this episode. And for those of you who don't know Dr. Jordan, she's going to give you a little bit of a background in terms of the work that she does in the world. But she really is a consummate authority on women's health and a very strong advocate for critical appraisal. How do we look at the evidence and ensure that it applies to us? So what we're going to talk about today is we're going to go deep on women's health. And we're going to talk about some of the myths that exist in the ecosystem. And we're going to talk to and about this idea of asking the right questions. So I feel really strongly that the quality of your life is tied to the quality of the questions that you ask. And so we want to go right down and grab the essential pieces of information that we need to know as health consumers to understand what pieces of the headline are actually relevant for us, what we need to know in terms of positioning our health towards a state of optimization, and what things we can let go by the wayside. And I really can't think of a better guest to help us with that conversation. Jordan, can you share with everyone a little bit of a background in terms of who you are and why this is an arena where you are so competent and passionate?
For sure. So I'm a naturopathic doctor, but really my journey started way before that when it comes to, you know, evidence-based practice and critical appraisal, which is really just like reading information and literature and then deciding, you know, sort of the level of truth of it. That's kind of how I describe it. So I was fortunate enough to be in the second intake of students at McMaster University for their Bachelor of Health Sciences program, which was a program that was developed. I mean, I don't even know. I say everything was 10 years ago, even though now I feel like I think it's 20 years ago. But it was modeled after their medical program with this idea that we needed to have skill development in learners, not fact acquisition, which is how most university programs are run, right? You sit in a lecture, they tell you lots of things, you then, you know, do those things on a Scantron, or you shade in your little bubbles, and we've granted you, you know, this, you know, we've bestowed this knowledge on you, and now you are ready to go into the working world. This is really not how this program was run. The best example is on that very first day of walking in, it was small group learning. And on the very first day when I walked in, we said to our instructor, we're like, are you the instructor? Like, there was just this person sitting at the front of the room. And we're like, are you the one who's running the class? And some brave soul who was willing to ask. And she said, well, how do you think you could find that out? And then we sat there, like, we're 20, right? And we're sitting there, we're like, well, are you the instructor? And she's like, well, how could you figure that out if I was the instructor? And it sent us on this like 20-minute investigation, pulling out our computers, looking up online who was supposed to be our teacher. Could we find a picture of this person online to verify that she was our teacher? And turns out she was our teacher. And that's how the program started, was like, how could you find that out? And what it did from day one was not give us facts ever. It was to develop us as learners, develop us as researchers, critical thinkers, and people who have this long-term ability to shift with evolving literature and medicine, which is really what some of our greatest challenges in medicine are, is that by the time this podcast is over, you know, thousands of articles will have been published and our knowledge or our truth that we know it will have shifted. So are we training physicians and are we training professionals to be able to shift with that information? Or are we sort of releasing them into the wild after they graduate with a very limited knowledge set that is going to, you know, have a date of expiry stamped on it, essentially? And so I took that sort of program that I went through, which was deeply in health sciences and figuring out what's real in medical literature, and then became a naturopath, which is a little bit of an ironic choice. But I do feel very passionately about preventative health and medicine. I really like, you know, sort of that transformative relationship that I get to have with patients in naturopathic medicine, which we don't always get to have in conventional medicine. And so I chose naturopathic medicine and now offer, you know, that knowledge building for clinicians. And so I've evolved my own personal career to support clinicians in their pursuit of skills that help them be more evidence-based in their practice. So that's sort of that was kind of a long version of how I got to where I am right now. But it literally started when I was 20 and I like walked through the doors of McMaster and they were like, it was boot camp for how you become a lifelong learner and someone who's willing to go against the status quo, essentially, and create, you know, what medicine really should be, which is this ongoing questioning of our reality to make sure that we're always in pursuit of better and more accurate knowledge.
There's two directions I want to go after this, and I'm really struggling. One of the biggest things I find is a challenge for medicine and health in general is this ongoing battle between exactly what you're talking about. How do we ask the right questions? How do we make this an ongoing investigation into the best, I think, applied science? And the need to be right. I feel like there's this overwhelming internal battle that exists between clinicians of all credentials and the evidence with respect to, well, you know, I need to be right. I need to be the authority. I need to actually have an opposite opinion to other people. What role do you think the need to be right is playing in terms of the application of medicine at large right now?
Well, I think we haven't embedded enough personal development in the education of clinicians for them to see their ability to self-reflect and evolve, deconstruct their own knowledge. Like, we're not giving gold stars for that ever, right? We're never giving gold stars for people saying, I knew what I knew, and I'm learning something different now, and I'm going to integrate that new knowledge into what I knew, and turns out what I knew yesterday is no longer correct. We're not giving stars for that. We're giving stars for who talks the loudest, who talks the most, who sounds the most confident, whether or not what they're saying is accurate or not. Whereas my entire training, and really, I only realized how valuable it was now looking back on it. We were given grades on our ability to be vulnerable. We were given grades on our ability to communicate our weaknesses to our instructors. And it created a culture of, I'm evolving, right? The culture was like, I am getting gold stars for evolving. And I feel like that it allowed me to see vulnerability. It allowed me to see the phrase, I don't know, but I'll find out. Or the phrase, it depends, which really almost every answer in medicine should end with or start with, like, it depends. And yet we see people presenting things as like the absolute truth and fact without that conversation, right? Without the other side, without being able to say, well, there might be a population that doesn't benefit from this actually. And so I think that's part of the problem. It's not embedded in education, and not just medicine. It's not embedded in any education for us to be able to have this self-development integrated as part of our reward system. We're rewarding people for staying up late and filling in a Scantron and pretending to be confident at the front of the room, not someone who's willing to like continuously deconstruct what they know and rebuild it with new information, which is exactly what we need to have happen in medicine.
Well, I think we're seeing that in real time right now as the world manages Corona, and that what was true last week presented through the media has been completely deconstructed. And now there's new recommendations this week. And what I'm observing is it's creating a tremendous amount of stress on the population at large. It's almost like it didn't occur to people that science is evolving, that as we have more information, we're going to change what we are presenting to the world. And this to me is sort of science 101 that I feel like we've missed the mark on. What are some of the, and you may disagree on that, but what are some of the ground rules that we need people to understand about science and physiology and the body before we start to talk about some of the myths that exist out there? Because for anyone who's waiting for it to be like, here's the truth about coronavirus or estrogen or your periods or anything else, we need to stop dismissing all science because it evolves. I think we just actually need a new set of ground rules. What are some of those foundational pieces that you'd love for people to know?
How long do we have?
Jordan.
Well, I'm going to start by saying that I think, you know, what we see happen in science, or what should happen in science, is that we should always be converging on some kind of truth or some kind of answer. And that's one of the ways to know if the information that you're reading is true, kind of true, on a theme of truth, is that in general, in science, we see information converging on a theme, and we see things moving towards what we are better understanding as the truth, even though that goalpost of truth keeps moving as we get closer to it, because the more we understand, then the more questions there are to ask, and then the more like rabbit holes that we need to go down. But really, we should be sort of moving on a theme. And that's, so I will say when I'm giving lectures, I'll say, you know what, if I read a study that said that fish oil killed people, like, A, I hope that I would be willing to read to the end, right? And not let my bias that fish oil is probably not killing people interfere with my ability to read the article. However, if it's one article as a outlier, and there are thousands of articles saying that fish oil doesn't kill people, then I'm probably not going to put a ton of weight into it, or I'm not going to, you know, change my daily practice based off that one article. But when we start to see multiple articles coming out that are on a theme, right? Well, this article, fish oil killed people, and in this article, it just harmed them. And in this article, they threw up. And in this article, they got worse. Now we're starting to see a convergence in the conversation that we need to disrupt what our current understanding of something is in order to reintegrate this new information. Maybe it's not as good as we thought. Maybe there are some scenarios under which it's not that great. Maybe it actually truly does cause harm and our previous studies had some flaw in it that we need to examine. Like overall, I want to see the conversation in science be moving towards some kind of truth. And so online, and what some of the challenges we see with, you know, the media and whatnot, is that you see a lot of headlines or things that are the outlier, right? It's the one person who this horrible thing happened to under these circumstances, and now we're concerned. Right? When, I mean, technically that one article or that one person is the fish oil killing people example, right? It's the outlier. We overall see that the theme is X, and now we've got this weird purple spotted Y over here. But the way that it gets presented in the media is that everything is equal, right? And that one odd story starts getting presented as if it's the truth, or if it should weigh in as equally as the 9,000 other stories that had a different theme. And I know I'm not really answering your question, and I went off on my own tangent.
No, it's you know, I think this is really important, because I think this notion of outliers, you know, I was talking about the ground rules. So, you know, science is evolving. And then two, we get these headlines that pull us off course. I think people understanding an outlier is really important. These are these individuals or circumstances that happen within the purview of a study, but they're different than what most of the data is telling. And while it's interesting to go after them, they're not necessarily the main cohort of what we're seeing exist. And the idea of an outlier to me led to this next concept that I also think that we need to address before we get into the myths. It's the last one I'm going to make us do. And that's this idea of bias. And even as you were talking about outliers, one of the biases I know that I have as a naturopathic doctor is I spent my career treating the outliers. The outliers were the ones who came to me. So the people who all did well on that mainstream drug and had no side effects, they're like, I'm tickety boo. Like, you know, pharma saved my life. And then the people who are like, I had all the side effects and I didn't get well and all these things happen, those are the people that always found me. And I was sort of halfway through my clinical career where I had to stop and go, Megan, you are developing an absolute bias towards the existence of these outliers, because it is actually the main population that you are treating. And so it was a bias I had to rein in, and I had to make sure I was aware of as I was evaluating science and I was engaging in conversation. But I'm wondering if you could speak to some of the biases at large that are actually informing consumer health in general right now, that, you know, the average person, when they're watching the news or they're reading an article or they are, you know, listening to their friends, need to be aware of.
For sure. And that's such a great question. I actually started one of my lectures once to a group of practitioners by asking, okay, like before we start, can you raise your hand if you're biased? And no one put up their hand. And they were like, you can tell they're all thinking, they're like, no, I'm not biased. And yet, like, everyone has bias. And again, like, the gold star should be for you being able to examine your bias daily. And that's one of my promises that I make to my patients when I'm working with them, is that I am willing to examine my bias daily. And when we talk about bias in research, we talk about, so essentially what bias is that we're skewing the setup of the argument in a way that's going to cloud the way we interpret the results. So if we only grab people from, you know, a wealthy tennis club to study, that's maybe not going to be generalizable to the rest of the population. If we only study men, which is often what we see in research, that information is maybe not going to be generalizable. And so those kinds of biases, I think it's easy for us to see. Oh, a drug company funded that study. That's biased. But what we don't realize is that as an individual and as a consumer, we also are at risk of having our own personal bias cloud, or maybe rose color, the lens through which we're seeing information. And I would think the one that is the most prominent for a consumer is something we call confirmation bias, which is that we have a set of beliefs and we are way more likely to align ourselves with people, with media, with pictures, with information that confirms the thing that we already think. And we're less likely to agree with, or we're more likely to find flaws in information that doesn't collaborate with the thing that we already thought about it. And we see this in the way people construct even their social media feed, right? How diverse are the conversations in your social media feed, or are they converging on a theme to say X is good and Y is bad? And so now when you see someone talk about Y as being something so great, your initial reaction is like, no, it isn't. Right? And no amount of information that that person presents on their argument is going to change your mind, because it's not confirming what you already think or believe. And I think we see that in the conversation around COVID and coronavirus, is that people have a stance on what they think and feel about this situation. And information that gets presented that's contrary to that, even if it's really, really true and accurate, we have a very hard time shifting our mindset and our belief base to then even allow that information into our space. We won't even watch the news that is contrary to what we believe, right? We shut it off. So confirmation bias is a tough one. And we'll do it in medicine too, where we'll say, I believe in, you know, the keto diet, because I know we said we were going to talk about the keto diet. So if someone believes in the keto diet and they find another person who benefited from the keto diet, they're like, see, it is the best diet. And if they see someone fail on another diet, the paleo diet, they would say, see, the keto diet is the best diet. When neither of those two facts, that one person succeeding and on the keto diet and that other person failing on some other diet, neither of those two things prove that the keto is the best diet, but it's confirming the bias that they already have. And so they use it as information and as fuel. And we see that often in social media, where they'll say, I had a client who, and it's like, well, that's nice. Like, everyone has a client who XYZ, right? That's not science. It doesn't make it the absolute truth that one person who ate grapefruits lost weight, right? And so confirmation bias is the one that's maybe the most significant. The other thing we're going to see for sure around this is publication bias. And that's much more of a contentious topic around censorship, et cetera. But publication bias essentially is that we'll publish certain sets of data and certain information over others. And certainly in the media, they're going to drive the themes of conversation that have an agenda. And we maybe don't see all aspects of the conversation because it's not on agenda or it's not, but publication bias is another one that is very common. And that leads to confirmation bias, right? Because if the only thing people are seeing are variations on the same theme, then how can they develop an alternative thought process about something they can't? Because they're just not getting that information. But it's important. And when I'm talking to people about how to broaden their understanding of a concept, I'm like, well, how much of the information that you're consuming is contrary to what you already believe? Because that's the biggest challenge that we have just in general, but also in medicine. And even for practitioners, will say, well, I've done it like this for 15 years. I'm like, well, cool. It's wrong now. And we have to change the way we do it. But it's hard because it's now, we've never awarded people, I was go back to my gold star statement, we've never given people awards for changing their mind. And really, we should.
Well, and it's so interesting you use the word belief. I believe in the keto diet. And I think it's, back to ground rules, science isn't a belief system. But we need to appreciate that it's frequently manipulated by people who do have belief systems and are trying to drive an agenda. And, even over the course of the last weekend, there were media reports that were coming out that, governments within Canada were withholding key pieces of information because it changed the narrative of how they thought the population was going to respond to coronavirus. And that doesn't surprise me. I'm not being a conspiracy theorist when I say that. I suspected that was the truth all along, because how are we going to get people to follow any kind of directive when, one, science changes every day and we don't understand that? And two, we're trying to really invoke a mass behavior change, which is quite difficult in general with respect to health. But I love this, where this conversation is going, because it enables us as the consumers of not just science, but the way science is presented, to be asking better questions. So let's get into some of these elements of women's health, where in many cases, there has been a, maybe manipulation is too strong, a manipulation of the science, but there has been a reworking of the science to make some concepts in women's health slightly more palatable, easier to understand. And we called this out before we got on to the conversation, something we called dopamine-driven medicine, meaning it's super exciting and super novel. And we get this dopamine flood because we're trying out the cool latest test instead of, you know, eating vegetables or drinking water. So let's talk about this in the context of testing, because there are tests that are available with respect to women's health that I think have some value, but are challenging in the landscape. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to testing and something that people need to be aware of?
For sure. And I have so many taglines about this because I talk about it so often. But when I start to talk to women about testing, or just patients about testing in general, and talking about it from this evidence-based perspective, I mean, we have to understand that, like, we have what we would call the gold standard of testing and assessing patients. And what that means by gold standard is that it means that it has stood up to rigorous scientific study to ensure that the test tells us something we care about, right? Which is, and I know as you're listening, you're probably going, well, don't we care about all the answers to all the tests? And it's like, well, no, actually, we don't care about all the things that can be tested. We can test lots of things that have no clinical relevance or no real meaning. And so when we say that something's the gold standard, it means that it stands up, that it tests something we actually care about, that by testing the person, we can actually change their trajectory of their health. Because again, that isn't always the case. Just because we can test something doesn't mean we change their life. That the test is accessible, is easy, is inexpensive, is reliable, is reproducible. And so when we talk about gold standard testing, that it, a test really needs to check off all of those boxes for us to consider it part of a person's health plan. And so when I start to talk about testing, because often people will land in my one-on-one practice and say, you know, they're gesturing to their body and they're like, I want my hormones tested. Like, something must be wrong. I need something tested. And, you know, the reality is that doing tests doesn't always get us to the goal where that person is trying to go. And we have very basic diagnostic tests that most people are skipping in favor of more, I always call them fancy, like more fancy tests to try and understand the minutiae of the person's health, when we haven't actually looked at like the very basics of their health. And so for a test to be reliable, to be valuable, to be helpful, it needs to tell us something we don't already know, right? So if we can look at a patient and say, well, you have a lot of acne, I know things about you. By seeing that acne, I don't need to test you per se. And it needs to change our treatment. So if we were going to put you on a diet with more protein and more vegetables and more olive oil, no matter what the test said, why are we running it? And so those are two good questions that people can kind of ask themselves when they're thinking about these, especially these like direct to consumer tests, that if you're spending, and it's not about the money, but if you're spending $500 or $600 on special fancy tests and have never had your iron tested, right? And you're like looking for this like deep meaning in your fatigue. Well, we've got thousands of scientific studies that show us that testing your iron is a really good place to start. And so I think you and I were talking about this off camera, Megan, is that often when people are looking at these sort of like fancy biohacking tests, like that's step like 1000. And they've skipped 999 steps in understanding their health and jumping straight to this very fancy assessment of hormones. And yet we're not even sure if testing those hormones actually teaches us anything about this patient or actually changes what we do with this patient. And yet we've missed all of these other steps with them. And I think that's a problem, right? I think because, like you said, like, it's not sexy to tell someone to get their iron tested. I mean, I've tried to write a sexy Instagram post about iron deficiency and it just doesn't work.
It doesn't land.
No. Mm-hmm. And yet,
hit the algorithm.
When you make people feel unique and mysterious and special, and people like that, right? People want to be a zebra in a crowd full of horses. They want to feel like their experience is so crazy and unique that they need a special test in order to be diagnosed. But the reality is that they've never talked to a doctor for longer than 7 minutes. That's why no one can figure out what's going on with them. And they need those other 999 steps before we would ever consider. We say, don't look for zebras in a crowd full of horses. Everyone has iron deficiency. Start there. And so I think, like you said, that dopamine-driven healthcare is that we can prey on women's insecurities, that they think their hormones are a problem, and sell them a test that exists, right? Like, we can test things, and we've reverse engineered the need for it. And so I use that term often, that reverse engineering. It's like, we can test estrogen in your urine. We made up a reason why we should.
Yeah, I think this is an important conversation. And listen, I talk about some of these tests sometimes on this podcast. So again, I don't want you guys to throw up your hands and be like, well, what are you talking about? What we're talking about is that there are probably 8 other things that should come beforehand. And so, you know, if I'm listening to you, Jordan, I'm just kind of pulling this back to, okay, how do we make this really relevant to people right now? And I ask these questions of my own clinicians all the time. And so the first question that I think everyone should be asking their clinician when they're being spoken to about a particular test, and listen, there's some fancy tests that I love as a clinician. Are there tests we should be running first? That is a really empowered question to ask your clinician, to ask your medical doctor, to ask your naturopathic doctor, to ask a nutritionist who's running tests. Are there tests we should be running first? Second question to that, if they're like, nope, let's do the fancy thing. The second question you should ask as the consumer, do your credentials allow for those required tests to actually take place? Because in some cases, people are saying this is the test we should run because they're not allowed to run the other ones. And that happens sometimes for us as naturopathic doctors. And it doesn't mean that, you know, running a test is wrong. It doesn't mean, as Jordan would say, that we don't want to look for what's called a surrogate marker. But it's an important question to ask as a consumer, again, back around this idea of informed consent. And then lastly, the question, and I ask this question all the time, especially with my kids. So my husband is a conventionally trained physician, and something will happen to our kids. He's like, oh, we should go get an x-ray. We should go do this. And all the time I ask this, I'm like, how will this inform our course of treatment? If they broke their finger, like, guess what? It's not actually going to change the course of treatment for us to sit and emerge for 6 hours and get it x-rayed for them to tape 2 fingers together. So it's actually a really important question, again, to ask your clinician, how will this test actually inform how we're going to get me towards that outcome and the treatments that you are going to select? And if it means you're going to save 6 months of investing in all sorts of supplements and treatments, then it's probably a good choice. But those are 3 really critical questions to ask. Do you have any that you want to add on there, Jordan?
I think the other big one is around like clinically relevant. And this is kind of speaking to what you were saying, is like, there's a difference between biochemical changes in a person's body and clinically relevant outcomes. And so often when we walk in the space of integrative medicine, we're talking about biochemical changes. So even, and this happens often in the world of fertility, where we're like, we want the mitochondria in your eggs to be healthy. Here, take these antioxidants, right? And it happens in practice. And sometimes it even happens in my practice, where we're treating mitochondria and we're not treating women, right? Or we don't know if treating mitochondria actually makes any more babies. And so a good question to ask is like, well, what is the expected outcome? Is the expected outcome that your insulin changes in your blood work, but nothing else changes? Is the expected outcome that you have less heart attacks? Is the expected outcome that you have less fatigue, or that you sleep through the night, or that your acne gets better? Or is the research on this particular nutrient, I pick on indole-3-carbinol all the time, or I3C, there is literally Well, there's two clinical trials on indole-3-carbinol, and both of them are on cervical dysplasia, which is not what people use it for. People use it for estrogen detoxification. We have zero idea about what that does to the woman. We know in a test tube, it changes what happens to their estrogen. Does the woman know? Can she feel it? Does she live longer? Does she actually get less breast cancer? We don't have the answers to those questions. And yet we will present the information as if this is like the most important thing you do is that you fix your estrogen metabolism. We don't actually know what that does for women. And yet these women are tired, burned out, have irregular menstrual cycles. Like they have literal, real, clinically relevant health concerns that are not being addressed in favor of us chasing arrows and mitochondria and these like kind of like this biohacked approach to health when they have glaring health issues sitting in our offices. And that's, I think, what I have the biggest problem with is that we're looking for the like magic, special, dopamine driven, sexy solution for sometimes like really basic health concerns in women. And women are attracted to shiny, extreme solutions. If we want to loop this back around to talking about the keto diet, right? Like that is not a diet that we have studied in women at all, or with the rare exception of a couple of studies. And I will say some of them have been published in the last like 18 months. And so great. Like maybe we're going to change the answer. And maybe in 5 years, I'll be back on the podcast saying, oh, the keto diet's the most amazing thing ever. I don't know. But as it sits right now, we have a handful of research studies looking at this diet. We don't track things like fatigue and PMS and irritability and sleep. And all of those things we know are deeply influenced by a lack of carbohydrates in a woman's diet. And so again, women are attracted to the extreme, shiny, fast solutions plan. And we're missing the fact that this is creating other gaps in the rest of her healthcare. And I have real problem with that, right? I have problem when things are presented as like the end all be all solution for people without them being able to ask questions about whether or not this is the right fit for them. Because turns out the headline on why the keto diet was so great was actually for type 2 overweight diabetic men. It was great for them and it helped them lose some weight. And so we went, you know who else wants to lose weight? Women. And we applied that solution to women because, again, we're reverse engineering a solution to fit a market need when the headline was not about women. The headline was about men and diabetic men at that.
So where does individualized medicine fit into the landscape of the randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial in terms of finding a middle ground? I had individuals who would come to me. We would do extensive genetic testing. We would do some advanced testing. We had done the basics. It was so imperative to how I practiced, but we also would step into that realm of individualized medicine. How do we address that next frontier of care and bring it back to the conversation we're having today?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. And I do think like when we talk about individualized medicine, we really should remember that what we're talking about is individualizing the plan for the patient. I think when we talk about individualized medicine as clinicians, we mistakenly talk about it as that this is my individual way to practice. And so people will individualize their care by being Dr. Keto, and it's individual because they're an individual as a clinician. That's not the individual we're talking about. The individual we're talking about in individualized medicine is the patient, which brings us back to the, it depends, right? What solution are we going to use? It depends. And that really is individualized medicine at its finest, is that we listen to the patient. It's patient-centered, autonomous decision-making where we lay out a buffet of treatment solutions and we individualize the solution based on what the patient's needs are. And maybe we individualize the order that we do some things in based on that person. Maybe we individualize the emphasis we place on one thing over another based on that person. right? And where they're at and what they can afford and how much time they can commit to their, you know, their strategy. That's where the individualization comes from, not the practitioner. And when the practitioner puts themselves in the center of that individualized care, that's when we skip steps in assessment, because that practitioner uses a special test to test their patients versus the saying, well, what does this individual across my desk need? So I think that's a really important distinction, because I'm not saying that patients shouldn't be treated as individuals because we have randomized control trials telling us what to do. I'm saying the clinician needs to know what those randomized control trials say so that the solutions they bring to that person have the best chance of being efficacious. And not the other way around, where we're bringing them the zebra solution and turns out they were a horse and they needed someone to just test their freaking iron, right? And so the individualization and the strategy, I actually think, is the future of healthcare. Because when we look at the challenges we have in healthcare, and so many of those challenges actually come down to the fact that people don't get enough time with their practitioners, and they don't get enough strategic coaching around their solutions. And so we say, we slide them a piece of paper across the table that says, go home and lose weight and your cholesterol will get better. But we don't implement a strategic plan for how to navigate the fact that they eat out for lunch as part of their job, or that they work night shift, or that they are self-employed, or that they have five kids. That's the part that healthcare is missing, is how do we individualize the solution to meet the person's needs so that they can be successful with it. And so I do think that that's where medicine needs to go, is that we do have those, you know, those options available for that person to gain a unique experience as we pursue the best solution. Maybe it doesn't mean that the solution changes. Maybe the answer is still fish oil and iron and drink more water, but how we support that person in pursuit of those options that are the most evidence-informed solutions we have. That's where the individualization comes in.
I love that answer, and I'm thoroughly enjoying this conversation. I feel like we should, one, we need a part two for sure. I also feel like this is a perfect place to transition the nature of this conversation into something I call our KPIs, or key performance indicators. So just like we have them in our business, I believe we have them in how we live our lives as well. So I've got some rapid fire questions coming your way. You ready?
I'm ready.
I love the birds in the background.
Can you hear the birds?
It's brilliant. I hope those don't get edited out, because it's so perfect. Jordan just has birds flying around her head, like picture Cinderella. And first question for you, what is your most recommended book?
I feel like my answer changes all the time, because I deeply love to read, you know, sort of personal development, self-help books. I just finished Never Split the Difference. And I honestly feel like that book by Chris Voss, like, literally has changed my life. And so right now that's my answer, but my answer has evolved certainly over the years, but that one's my current like favorite.
What is your favorite health hack?
Weightlifting, like my own personal favorite health hack. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a massive weightlifter. Like to me that's been an absolute game changer in my own personal health, whether it's from mental health or improving like my posture, body pain, body composition, energy, sleep, resiliency under stress. Like I literally can't think of a tool that's been more effective at me being a successful entrepreneur than weightlifting and like inducing stress in my body through exercise. There's so many times, and I know this is supposed to be a rapid fire answer. I'm sorry. This is a long answer. There's so many times where I view stress in my life and I'm like, okay, one more rep, Jordan, right? Like, and that resiliency build has come from pushing myself physically through weight training.
Yeah, it's a great answer. I, you know, again, rapid fire. I did a cold plunge this morning after my shower, and that's exactly why I do it. Like it's about that physiological resilience, that mental resilience, and you just feel awesome. How would you define your purpose?
I think my purpose is to help people get access to accurate health information, but also develop themselves as a good critical thinker. And I want that for clinicians, and I want it for patients. I want patients to read a newspaper article about how bacon is killing people and be able to read between the lines and understand what it really means and whether or not that article is about them and whether they actually need to stop eating bacon or not. But I deeply want the same thing for clinicians. And when I thought about like my level of impact that I would like to have, there's only so many women that I can work with in my one-on-one practice. If I really want to change the face of medicine, I need to work with clinicians and I need them to develop the skills so that they know if bacon is going to kill people or not, so that they can go out and help all of the people that they're working with. So that's my mission and purpose, essentially, is to create more evidence-informed practitioners and people so that they have the ability to navigate healthcare for themselves.
Last question for you. Entrepreneurism, are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
I knew this question was coming and I feel like I've been thinking about it for a week. So
that defies the purpose of rapid fire.
I know, but I knew this one was coming. And I think about this all of the time because my husband and I are both entrepreneurs and like serial entrepreneurs, not meaning that we, you know, jump from thing to thing, but meaning that we're like constantly developing our purpose and our businesses to fulfill like needs for other people, but also fulfill our family's needs. And we actually both went to that program at McMaster. And we talk about this often. We're like, were we born this way? Or did we develop it? Because in those formative years, we actually were given an opportunity to transform the way that we think. And I do think it was nurtured. I do think there was an aspect because I was not born into an entrepreneurial family at all. I'm the only entrepreneur in my entire family / extended family. My family, even my parents are risk adverse, right? When it comes to their employment and all of that. And then there's me. And I do think that it was nurtured through my experiences, which gives me hope that all of these skills are teachable, right? That we can train people to think differently about their bias and about what they think they know and transform the way that they consume medicine by helping them gain skills. Because I did it, right? I was born in this very like risk adverse family. And yet I create opportunity and create income out of nothing. And so I do think it was something that was developed.
Well, I am so glad that you have developed these sets of skills, that you are doing the work that you are doing. You are leveraging your background as a clinician. You've built this incredible platform for your colleagues and for other clinicians to be able to continue to grow and think in this way. Where can we send people, Dr. Jordan Robertson, to learn more about the work you're doing in this world?
Yeah, for clinicians, the space to go or to start to explore what I do with clinicians and how to become more evidence-informed, you're going to want to navigate to theconfidentclinicianclub.com, where that's our online education platform where we move clinicians through a process of becoming more evidence-informed and evidence-based, but also I literally just hand you all of the things that I do with patients and all of my years of experience and research on clinical topics. We just give our members access to my protocols and everything that I do with patients every single month. That's where clinicians are going to want to find me. For patients and for the public, Instagram's a great sort of landing place to figure out how best to interact, meaning I have my own podcast, Women's Health Unplugged, where we do a deep dive every week on clinical topics in women's health. It's also the where to find my one-on-one clinical practice where we serve women in Ontario. That's really the best place to find me, and it's Dr. Jordan ND on Instagram. So Dr. Jordan ND. That's really the best place to find me because then you can navigate to, you know, the area that kind of serves your needs the best. Plus I really like memes. And so there are a lot of memes there on my Instagram.
Pretty funny. It cracks me up. Yeah, it's a great place to get a sense of not only how you think, but who you are. And I absolutely adore you. This was such a fun conversation. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
I feel like that episode actually could have gone on all day long. Jordan is such a wealth of information, and I feel like the nature of this conversation is just so relevant to our success as we attempt to navigate the news and society at large. And as we have more information available to us, as health becomes more democratized, our ability to understand how to listen to the information and the science that actually informs the headlines is going to become more and more critical to our success. This is the kind of conversation that I love to have with high performers, those individuals who are interested in leveraging their health and taking it to the next level. If you are one of those people and want to be part of our community, you can join us for free on Facebook. We have a group there called the Anthropology Collective, and we go deep on the science of health, entrepreneurship, and the intersection with mindset. Coming up next week, I'm going to be discussing my rules for freedom. This is going to be a solo episode done just by me, where I talk about the rules that I choose to live by so that I can have a seamless interplay between what's going on in my business life and my personal life. I have decided to abandon this notion of attempting to find balance and instead have designed a set and series of rules that I reevaluate on a quarterly basis to set my intention for how I want to live my life, how I want to extend my business, and look at the impact and legacy that I want to leave behind. I'm going to talk about the rules that I am choosing to live by this quarter, what it means for my business and for my life, and the process I use to go about creating those rules in the way that I live. That episode will drop for all of you next Tuesday, like every Tuesday, when we release new episodes of the Anthropology Podcast. Until we meet then and until we meet again, as always, I am Dr. Megan Walker, wishing you an impactful week ahead.